afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. We are live on Sedona Talk Radio and also on Blog Talk Radio on the Internet. Thank you so much for being with us today. It is a great day. You know, today I'm here in the South, and it's been raining for the past 5 days. I feel kind of waterlogged, and we always like to say, oh, my gosh, I'm so sick of that. I really want to see the sun. But you know what? I know the sun's coming, and it's going to be 110, and it's going to be even hotter that in the heat index. So you know what? Just like Arizona, you know, it's hotter than blazes. You either have that oven heat and dry heat, or you've got the heat and the humidity in the south. Take your pick. I don't know why I always end up in these places. But anyway, so today we have a lovely guest. Our guest is Kevin Scott Hall. His book is A Quarter Inch from My Heart, a memoir. And let me tell you, when I saw about this book, I said, ah, Katrina, everybody, you know, here we live in the South. We always see that word and we think, oh, kindred spirits, they must know our story. You know, we can at least relate. We have something to connect to. We're still saying this now almost 10 years later, you know, since Katrina, and we're all getting a headache, you know. But that is our life. And today, Kevin is going to be telling about his story, about his life, a quarter inch from his heart. And, you know, it's something that you're never going to expect, so I'm not going to give away the clip on the story until we get into talking about it. But what's very important about it is about opening hearts. And I know after Hurricane Katrina here in the South, everybody got dislodged and they went to other places. We went to Texas. We stayed for the storm for about a week and we just decided, you know, hey, we're going nowhere if the water's up to you know where on us. So we found out how to wade out of it and we got out. We went to Texas and we just couldn't resonate with the people there. We just said, this isn't the place for us. It's just not fitting me. And so we came back. And a lot of other people found that they were standing on, as I would say, street corners, and it stripped from you your ideas of who you were, what you used to do, who you used to communicate with, what your community was like, what you remember, all your memories. And all of those things just clipped away quickly. And, you know, we always talk about it, and we see everybody, oh, they rebuilt, they're having fun, oh, look at it, it's great. We got paint on the walls, we stuck up some stucco, you know, hey, everything's great, the booze is flowing, and so is the music, everybody's great. Well, you know what, to this day, almost 10 years later, everybody's still on their PTSD and medications, everybody's drinking more than business, and crime is way up. So let's tell me, are they really doing better? You know, it's all about your insides and about how your heart and your soul can be healed. So today we'll be talking to Kevin about his book. So, Kevin, thank you so much for being with us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Dr. Jeanette. Can't wait to talk about the book.
You know, and we always say, you know, things happen for a reason. So I guess your book is all about what was the reason, right?
Yes, the story is a pretty wild, unexpected ride. When I invited somebody to live with me who had come up here after Hurricane Katrina, and it was a guy named Maurice, and I basically said, "Why don't you stay with me until you get back on your feet?" And yeah. I was thinking that would be a couple of weeks. It turned out to be over 2 years. So the book is mainly about that adventure of living with this near stranger roommate for two and a half years and what transpired and all of that.
You know, it's so interesting when I read through your book, and I always read books cover to cover when I get them from the guests in print, and I said, this person was just a figment there and was reflecting from him what needed to work within himself. In other words, you know, when we say our heart is really hard or things just aren't working out and why can't I figure things out, there will always be a test or there'll be someone or something that will present to you that will just open up another part of your being. And I really think that that was this book is about, you know. And a lot of people at that time that came out of this area were very open. We were raw. Hey, you know, there was nothing you could say or do to us. Well, you just looked at us. You saw bare skin and bones and, you know, open hearts that were just bleeding like nobody's business. And I think that's where a lot of people connected to people that came from here because they said, you know, I feel something. I don't know what it is. There's just this sense there that I need to do something. I have to be there. I need to connect. And that's how I think a lot of people have similar experiences to potentially what you may have had, you know?
Yes. You know, he was not a native of New Orleans. He'd kind of drifted around, and I think mm-hmm. he ended up there for a few months before he came up to New York. But I hear what you're saying. You're saying when he was living with me in New York, one of his complaints about New York was he missed that kind of Southern hospitality. He would often say things like, "Why can't people just, you know, make a plan to get together and you know, sit down on the porch and have a glass of lemonade," or something like that. He really was looking for a kind of connection that he may have had there or at other places that, you know, he didn't immediately find in New York because we're very busy. And I think that that's something those of us who live in New York could learn from that situation. And I learned from living with him that kind of living in the moment and a connection and not just being so stuck with the busyness of every day, you know.
Yeah, and you know, I've lived in the Northeast. I grew up there. And definitely it is about busyness. And I talk to so many people all the time in there. I have to go do this, I have to go do that. And, you know, my brother's even almost 60, and he says, well, you know, it's 7 days a week, it's this, that, and the other. And I said, you know, I know you're going and you think you're going right, but you're missing so much. Well, I have to. And, you know, they use that word, I have to. Because
right.
what? Because, you know, maybe because your plan has a big name on it and these are the only pieces of the puzzle you can fit into, I think we really need to look at that and say, you know, I want to create a different puzzle. I want to fit into something
right.
different. You know, I want to be nice. I want to be open. I want to be less rushed. I realize this life because, it clicks by like nobody's business. You know,
yeah.
as you've said in the book, you know, it goes by fast. You can't put a brake on it, so you'd best enjoy it.
Right. Right. And the other thing that I learned from the book, again, it was one of these situations where he pops into my life and if I had a moment to think about it, I would have said, well, I don't have time to deal with this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I did take that rare chance and just in the spur of the moment said, well, listen, you know, you're staying in a shelter. Why don't you stay with me until you can get back on your feet? And what I learned from that, I'm not saying that everybody should do that. There was a bit of danger involved in that, if I may say. But I learned that there is something to being spontaneous and following your heart and following what you think is the right thing. And in the long run, despite a lot of difficulties, a lot of blessings came out of this. And now I think because of the book, other people will learn some lessons as well, I hope.
You know, we always talk about the heart and everybody thinks, oh, you know, it's just something in my chest that keeps me going. I even sat down with someone one day and I was having a discussion. And I said, well, what do you call your heart? And the person said, oh, it's just a machine. And it was like, wow, how far removed are you from life, you know? And
right.
I would hear so many comments, you know, and I even was helping a woman she was an elder woman, and she was a gay individual, and she was in her early 60s, I think she was 62. And she had said, you know, when she called me up, that she was looking to connect with me.
Mm.
And I said, what do you need? I'd never met her before. And she said, I just got out of the hospital, and something's not right, and I need your help. When I went to her home, she was just taking a bunch of drugs, and she didn't know what she was doing, and she... Her partner was there at the house and kind of totally not even paying attention to her. And I could tell there was confusion in the house, and we finally cleared up a little of the confusion. Well, anyway, after 4 days of being there, I said, what do you really want? She says, I want a new heart. And I said, what do you mean you want a new heart? She says, my heart is broken. And I said, what do you mean? She said, here's all the lab tests. My heart's broken. Well, in actuality, when we got down to the transplant guy and we said, you know, okay, well, what can you do? He said, I would suggest you enjoy today. And he looked at me. telling me to have her enjoy her day. Well, we got out of the office, and we no sooner closed the door behind her butt, and she said, am I going to die today? I said, not today. And so we went around and enjoyed all of her places, you know, that she had been and everything, and she did pass away within a few, I think it was about a week and a half. And what we worked on, though, within that time period was, okay, you know, she would say things like, well, you know, I feel bad leaving my partner. I'm really worried about it. We just got a new car. How is she going to pay it off? You know, I didn't pay my last month on my funeral bills. You know, how is she going to take care of herself? She can't even run the washing machine. Somebody needs to show her how the washing machine. And I was thinking, why at the time of our life, you know, we run through our life so fast, just as
right.
you've said, in New York, you're running. And everybody's having these crises, you know, right at the end and hoping that spontaneously their life will have value, you know. But,
yeah.
you know, we worked on, you know, getting off some of her boundaries and her barriers and everything. We said, she'll be fine, you know, she'll let her figure it out and you can go peacefully. And she did. And she finally realized that no one was going to go with her, you know.
Right.
And it was going to be okay, and that's all people really want to know. And I think that's probably what the gift that you gave Maurice in the book is, that everybody has to go. They all have to go themselves, and it is going to be okay. And don't worry, because there isn't anything else you can do, right?
Right, right, exactly. And it was really just, I think, a gift for me as well as for him to just that process. I mean, I can just tell your listeners a little bit but you know, he stayed with me and he ended up getting very sick just when he seemed to be getting back on his feet. So I ended up being his caregiver until, you know, he did pass away. And, but it was a great kind of spiritual lessons and, For both of us, for me to take part in his journey and transition, and for him to, yeah, come to realizations about life, and just to see him kind of blossoming and coming to a newer understanding of life and appreciation for life as he neared the end. It's really a kind of a beautiful thing to see in a way, even though it's very sad as well. Yeah.
You know, but they always wait till the end, and you wonder, could you imagine life if everybody did that throughout their life?
Right. You know, that's a very good point.
If we lived that life, you know.
And I, you know, I tell people that in a way, you know, a lot of people said, "Wow, look what you did for Maurice in those 2.5
mm-hmm.
years," and I answer them often by saying, "Yeah, but look what he did for me." Because I'm
right.
still here, and I'm able to learn the lessons that he gave me. And that's why I say that, in a way, despite his troubles and that he went through and kind of brought to our home or whatever sometimes, I still think of him as that he was kind of my angel. Like, he came in and showed me things that I would not have seen otherwise, you know.
And you know what, sometimes I think too, and I've had these experiences with other people before, and they say that, you know, these people brought trouble or they brought these experiences that maybe I didn't want in my life. But really when I tell them, when I look at them, I would say to them, you know, but look, you're still here. So the danger
right.
and the danger and the fear was potentially an illusion. It really wasn't there because you're still here.
Right.
You know, in other words, it didn't take you down. It didn't create all of this stuff that you thought might have happened. It was something to notice, recognize, and move through versus,
right.
you know, pulling you into the toilet with it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm very fortunate that I am a writer, which, especially writing this book, which is memoir, digging through all this stuff again, it becomes a process where I have to uncover and try to find meaning in my experience, and so I'm very lucky that I have that gift that I can use that way, because it really becomes like, you know, this book was almost like 5 years of therapy with all the rewriting and things like that, what I got out of it. But yes, I mean, exactly that. I'm still here, so I reap the benefits of the lessons and the pain that I went through. So,
And it's definitely something that you sometimes don't want to experience, but you know you do.
Right. Even now, people, you know, have read the book and respond very positively to it, but they'll say, I could never do that. How could you have done that? Or something like that. But I look back and I say, during that time, my faith was never so alive. I was never so sure of or having to live day to day and saying, what am I going to do today? What am I learning today? How can I help this situation or whatever? But I was very much living through the moment during the good times and the bad, which sometimes when you're following a controlled plan, which I think we often try to do, there isn't as much magic going on, you know?
Yeah. I think sometimes when we say our path has already been written and we're just playing it out, it really gets to be rather boring. You know, we have to shake it up a little bit sometimes.
Right.
We can't always follow what other people, too, have created for us or expected us to do. And that is such a hard thing to bite off because so many people will say, you know, well, you're not doing what I'm telling you to do, or you're not fitting the pattern that I would think that should be going on, therefore I'm going to base judgment in it. That judgment is so dangerous.
Right. Yeah, in this case, if I had taken a couple of days to think about the situation when I met him in New York, if I'd taken a few days and said, oh, that's terrible, you're staying in the shelter, well, call me next week and let's see what's happening. You know, between that time, I probably would have talked to some friends and said, well, here's the situation, and I would have been talked out of taking him in as a roommate. So, yeah, all kinds of judgments would have come in, like which I got anyway, which was, you know, this is crazy. What are you doing? You hardly know this person. Whereas in that rare moment that where I kind of heard a voice that said, take him in, and I just listened to it, and I said, okay, here we go. Why don't you stay with me? And even as I was saying it, the sensor in me was going, what are you doing? This is crazy. But all during that time, I never really doubted the decision I made. I still think it was the right decision, you know?
And it's easy to be able to, because it's easy to say in retrospect, you know, but at the time, I'm sure you had a lot of judgments and a lot of thoughts when you were, like, throwing up your hands. I'm sure in the book you've written about a few of those.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it turned out the overcoming the trauma of coming up here after the hurricane or all that was just maybe one of the straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing, that Maurice had a background of a troubled past of growing up in a foster home and being let go from the foster home some sense of drifting around the country some possible mental health issues and some drug issues and criminal issues. So those are all things that kind of unfold that I discover and that the reader will discover as they go through the book. But, as I discovered those things, it's a little more of throwing up the hands. But then at the same time, I'm more involved, so it doesn't become as easy to just say, get out of my house. You know what I mean? It then becomes something, well, how are we going to solve this? How can we talk through this? How can I, you know, give you brotherly love despite this thing in your past or this thing that you are hiding or don't want to talk about, you know? And like I said, they became big, big lessons of love for me as well, to say, don't judge. You never know, like, who's going to walk through the door and change your life. You know, it wasn't about my changing his life. It was a two-way street. It's a two-way street, for sure.
I think it was almost being present in his and walking with him. You know, so many people are just looking for not really the answers all the time when they're asking people questions, or I would always say this in healthcare, when people are coming in and they're asking for help, they're not really asking for the help that you think they are. They're asking to be out of pain, to be loved, to be cared for, to someone to support them, you know, or whatever. So if we really, you know, started basing our life upon those adjectives and adverbs versus all of these other things that we think, you know, I want money, I want husband, I want house, I want job, you know, blah, blah, you know, and we might get a little bit closer to maybe where everybody's in the soup right now.
I mean, I think, and that was another issue that came up in the book or in the relationship. It was once I was kind of in it, I was thinking to myself, well, this is not, you know, what I would have wanted. You start saying to yourself, well, he's living with me. It wasn't a romantic relationship, but part of that was a judging of, like, it shouldn't be a romantic relationship. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You start second-guessing yourself on a lot of things and saying, it's not what I had planned, you know?
Yeah, the idea that you can always love someone, you just don't have to be in love with them, you know, the difference.
Right.
And to know it and to separate that out, you know, because so many people are afraid to use the word that you love somebody, but if they could realize the difference in those two phrases, that might set them a little bit freer to start saying a little bit more, yes, you know, I do care for you, I would support you, I am here for you, I do love you, in that love part. But you just don't have to be in love. You're in love with a lot less people. You do love people a lot more.
Yeah. 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 And that was another one of the big lessons for me in the book, was to find that I could love someone, learn to love somebody, and sex did not have to be part of that equation. You know, there's one point in the book where my pastor said, because, you know, I was bringing Maurice to my church and they were helping with him and all of that as well. And maybe a year or so into it, my pastor asked me, you know, are you two a couple now or something? And I answered the question by saying, well, we're not having sex, you know, as if that's what she was asking, you know. But that's in my head. I felt like that's what a couple is. We, you know, we sleep together. We're sexual partners. And I had to recount that in the book because it was kind of funny to me in retrospect, because I said, well, you know, in many ways we really did become a couple, and that might be why people like her and a few others thought there was something there. There was something there, but I couldn't define it, you know. I didn't know how to define it like I had to, you know.
You know, I think a lot of times we look at it and we say, it's more or less like you're meshing your energies. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, everybody is an energy anymore, you know, and how we just want to be around good people or good vibes or whatever. And we can feel people closer. So that's the point where you want to be, is when you're exchanging energy. So you probably could have felt it more, that gravitational pull between the two of you, is of helping and, you know, ebbing and flow of help, you know, care, consideration, you know, and as you said, teaching and supporting each other.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there were elements of that relationship that were deeper than I'd really ever had in any relationship before, whether it be, you know, a romantic relationship or a family relationship. So, there was actually more to that relationship than people often have, I think, you know, or that I had.
And, you know, you talk about it a quarter inch from my heart, and I was looking through, you know, as I was reading, to notice your references in which that title came to be.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, it could be a physical part, a quarter inch. It could be an emotional part. It could be almost any part. But it all depends upon just how much you to know when your heart needs it to be protected, as in one instance in your life, and when the other time when maybe you should have let your heart open out. So I guess maybe we go through life learning those different times, you know, when should I just protect myself and put that wall up, and when do I not need to do that?
Right. I'm thrilled that you got that very clearly. It was something that, you know, the title came to me somewhere in the process of writing the memoir over and over again. But, you know, to just, you know, explain to the readers, we're coming up on it. 20 years ago, I was assaulted on the street, and I was stabbed in the chest. And the doctor said the next day, the blade came a quarter inch from your heart. If it had moved mm-hmm. a little bit either way, you probably wouldn't be here today. And that always stayed with me. And when Maurice was living with me, because of all the, there was love, but there was also trust issues, and our backgrounds were so different, which made for kind of a dynamic mm-hmm. friendship, but at the same time, that trust thing and everything. That it struck me as a title later on, because I thought, you know, the physical blade came a quarter inch from my heart, and then all these years
right.
later, when I'm living with him, and what you're probably talking about is I kept him a quarter inch from my heart, because I didn't mm-hmm. quite want to embrace all the way. And
right.
I think that was a two-way street, nor did he. He had fears himself and all of that. So, yeah, I think you're exactly right. Sometimes you need that quarter inch, and then there are other times where you have to just say, stop with the space. Go all the way
yeah.
in. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yep, and then that brings us to the point where we had just said about, you can love people, but you don't have to be in love with them. So you can love them, and you could still keep up that sense of, you know, when I think about the quarter inch from the heart, as you said with the blade, a lot of people think about around their heart, they're going to have this really metallic shield. No one's mm-hmm. going to penetrate it. No one's going to get near it, you know.
Right.
But I always try to tell people, try to have it as an energetic thing, you know, so that the good will get in and the bad will stay away. And
right.
it's a little bit easier than always carrying around a metal part, which is probably what you had done. You protected yourself all those years and decades,
yeah.
and then this showed up and says you can't protect yourself anymore, you know. So
yeah.
going forth, then you just get this energetic heart where, you know, it's sort of like a cheesecloth, you know. Good can come in, the bad stays out, you know, same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great image, and it's I mean the lessons of that of letting go of the metal shield and letting people in and having that flow mm-hmm. of energy. I think it works. I think not only in relationships, but just in terms of, I think of myself here in New York all these years, and I do love New
mm-hmm.
York, and there's a great energy and a lot of great people here. But you know, for me. You know, many years trying to make it as a performer and a singer-songwriter and now as a writer and everything, and just having to deal with rejection, you know, almost daily.
Yeah.
And there are people, as you know, who can be bitter and jealous and angry and not want to let you in the door
mm-hmm.
and all of that, and you have to have a kind of a energetic, fluid heart to be able to take all that and say, it's okay. I need to let that go and stay
right.
myself. I can't turn, if my own heart turns hard, then I can't be the artist that I think I should be, you know, so not to mention the person I should be, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like you're coming out with a bleeding heart, and they're saying, "Ooh, it doesn't smell right. Ooh, it doesn't look right. Oh, is it crooked that way? Oh, I want it in pink. And not that shade of pink, but maybe it should be red." Right?
Right.
So you pretty
right.
much are carrying around your heart in that transition every day.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, the lessons that we go through in life through the some of the difficult things that I recount in the book are things that hopefully, like, they stay with me so that when I get in those situations where my heart wants to harden or something, I say, no, I've been through this, and I've been through this, and I've been through this, and
right.
you know, I can get through this, and I don't need to turn into, you know, the angry, bitter person full of attitude, you know?
And, you know, it's so interesting, too, because a lot of people, whether they have instances in their younger years or whatever went on in their household or in their lives, they tend to build up coating. Like, you know, you start getting a Teflon heart then, you know, because they say, you know, I've been hurt so many times. In other words, my heart has so many dings. I'm going to put it in a can and I'm going to cover it up with Teflon because there's nobody that's going to get near me again. And then they come through this life, you know, with anger and revolution in their lives and, you know, just this... this spirit of venom, you know, like it's just, you know, that it's just nothing's going to do, you know?
Right.
And I think in your book you dissolved a lot of that.
Well, thank you. I certainly hope so. And you know, that was one of the things that I think that I found attractive about Maurice as a person was that he had so many things that he had gone through. I mean, you know, basically losing his parents at the age of 12 and kind of finding his way through life after that and dealing with a lot of issues throughout life and everything. And yet, you know, there was something about him that was very childlike in a way that was funny and really just you wanted to give him a hug. I mean, but he did put up a certain tough exterior to some people, but if you kind of connected with him, like the people that allowed themselves to connect with him, they just, you know, found him to be just a beautiful person in and out. He was funny. He was smart. He, like I always say, the person who has nothing to lose can really be a wonderful person to be around, possibly dangerous too. But he had a certain edge to him, but he also just like had a real life force to him that you know, people saw even if they were only around him for a little while, you know.
You know, so. I think after Katrina, you know, well, actually the people in the South already had that ingrained into them about not worrying about material things or all these other big fancy things and all. That's how they live down here. But, you know, after Katrina, it kind of got better for many people. They said, you know, I don't even care about material things anymore, you know. Every time it comes up to hurricane season, you know, people would start talking about it, and I'd say, you know, if a storm comes, I'm opening my windows and wave my stuff goodbye, you know? And really, my address is not my home. My address is where my stuff lives. My home is myself.
Right.
And that's so important to remember. Like, everybody likes to verbalize it, and everybody rolls off, you know, poetry and authors and everything. Those words roll off their tongues, but they don't really sense it or know it unless they've experienced it, is that this is all just crap. This is all stuff.
Yeah.
This means nothing, you know? And it's so important to remember that.
Yeah, and I think that he learned that. There was I'll give away one little story in the book, but, you know, there was one point where he disappeared for a while. He was living with me, and then he disappeared for a while, and I didn't know what happened, and I didn't know he was coming back, and so I threw out all his stuff, you know. After a couple of weeks, I was like, oh, he's gone, he's drifted off somewhere else, and I threw away all his stuff. But then he did call me and found his way back into my life and back into my apartment, and he says, what happened to all my clothes, what happened to my stuff? And I said, I didn't know you were coming back, you didn't call, whatever, I threw your stuff out, I'm so sorry. And I felt terrible about it, and he was, you know, he was bummed about it, because that was no small feat, trying to come up with, you know, clothing and things when he arrived here with the backpack on his back, you know. And but the next day, he literally, it like water off his back. And next day he was like, okay, let's go to the Salvation Army. Let's see what we can get. And we actually made an adventure out of it, like finding new fun clothes for him to wear that wasn't going to cost a lot of money. And it was gone. You know, there were no grudges with him. You know, the next day it was on to the new thing, you know.
I think also, too, when you have all that taken away from you, like we talk about the storms, and, you know, when you have it all taken away, then it comes down to the core of who you are, and that's pretty much what you really want to be looking at. You know, when I look at my stuff, I'm like, you know, people say, oh, but I had that table, and it was when my kids were born. It's like, you know what, I'll look at my table and say, you know what, it's time for a new table. You know, you have to look at how you reframe it. It's time for a new table. It's okay.
Yeah.
Your memories are in your head. You don't have your memories on your table, you know. So we have to maybe cut that little cord that says, you know, my stuff is not my memory. My memory is myself, you know, what's in my head. And how hard that is to do for a lot of people. But also, too, you also explain in the book, you know, there's, as I went through reading the book, I could feel that there was a lot of judgments or barriers or things that wanted to be hidden that had to come to light. And they came to light in different venues. So I think we also need to remember that a lot of people do walk around with things that they hide, that they don't want other people to know. And, you know, sometimes holding on to them, you know, if you've got a Teflon heart already sealed in, all it does, if you're hiding them in there, all it's going to do is, hey, you know what happens when you suffocate a plant? It dies. Hearts do too.
Yeah, and you know that's a really great, a great point, and definitely a running theme that you notice, because the, as different as Maurice and I were as people, as backgrounds and things like that, I think that we had that in common. We both kind of we knew how to hide things we didn't want other people to see. And they, you know, like there were certain things that we were ashamed of or whatever, and trying to put up this front of something that was a little bit false and not complete. When the book came out, the funny thing was when the publisher accepted the book, they said, oh, this is a really great story, you know, we love the story and we'll take it. And then they sent back the manuscript a couple of weeks later, and there were red marks all through. And I said, I thought you guys liked this. Wow.
Right.
And they said, we do. We love the story, but you're telling it like a journalist, like this happened and this happened and this happened. But where are you in it? Where is your heart? Where is your soul? So I really had to dig and do an excavation and to do a rewrite, because I was hiding so much of myself. I was having, you know, I was content to talk all about, well, this guy Maurice came into my life, and here's what he was like, and this is what happened, but somehow wanted to keep a distance of what was going on with me. So, it was a process for me to unhide, to come out, to come clear about a lot of things, and a lot of friends and people who have known me for a long time have read the book, and you know, I had that reaction from a lot of people, shocked. They were like, I didn't know this, and, you know, I didn't know this was going on. And so, yeah, I realize now, like, that is part of the great thing about the memoir writing process, too, is it's allowed me to share my honest self and some of the struggles that I've gone through with readers who are my friends and readers who are not my friends, you know, or people that I don't know.
And, you know, it's interesting when people say, well, I didn't know that, as if that was going to change the process of you knowing them. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And they do. So there, again, is their judgment placed upon it, whereas you just did what you needed to do and you kept going, which was even fine also. But, you know, we really want to get to the point where those barriers and those boundaries just don't pop up all the time, you know, because they really don't service anybody, you know. And as we said in the beginning of the show, when it comes to the end of your life, hey, God doesn't take UPS, nor does he take labels, you know. He's just going to recognize you for who you are. Not what you are, not what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. It's not going to make any difference. You know, it's just you. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's powerful. A label-free life. Yeah.
Yeah, and how can you even get that, you know? But it's also, too, you know, you talk about, you know, I think we talked about, you mentioned AIDS in the book. So I know that's a topic sometimes a lot of people don't want to mention, but we'll just cruise over it a little here. because of my own experience with it. You know, everybody has known, you know, I worked as a dental hygienist, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and I live in New Orleans, and that was the number one place where there was a lot of AIDS that was discovered in the 80s. And you know, a lot of judgment, I believe, we as people, there have been different events in history that have really changed what type of people we are today. Either if we're in our 60s or in our 20s, these judgments are coming up. You know, I always like to say the worst inventions were always the jet plane and the internet, because the jet plane really broke up communities. You know, we didn't have a sense of who we were. You know, we couldn't go see our grandmother in 2 seconds down the street, or, you know, someone was sick, everybody would be sitting on their porch. I mean, granted, maybe not New York City, but, you know, in the North they used to do that, because I grew up there. I know that they did that. It's just that when everything started breaking up, that we don't do that anymore. And then we look at the internet, you know, where everybody started to learn more things, and they said, I'm going to one-up you. I'm going to know more. I'm going to one-up you because I'm going to make more. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then you look at how people are themselves. And I really would always marked at the time in the 70s when AIDS came along is that in my mind, the major break when people started to move away from each other physically. In other words, don't shake their hand, don't sit at the pews, I don't know who you are, I don't know anybody. And they wouldn't talk to anybody, or that, you know, you'd see people, all these kinds of crazy habits brewed up. And I think that's when that started to move people away. And then we look at the internet, now it's really moved people away. People are no longer interacting anymore. So the age of Teflon hearts, hey, I think we are full-blown in the age of Teflon hearts right now, you know? But we also have a whole lot of them that are blooming. So there's this really contrast going on now these days about, you know, who's out there and helping and who isn't.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are historical shifts and things like that. But, you know, it's interesting, a couple of years ago, before his recent comeback, I'm also a journalist, and I had interviewed Nile Rodgers. You may know him as the producer in that group Chic, the disco group, back in the late 70s. But, you know, he did a memoir a few years ago, but he talked to me about how what was great about that era was that people were going out and dancing together, and it was gay people and straight people and black people and white people, and he said that that his theory was that the power structure did not like that, because it was suddenly you had all these people mixing together, and very soon after that there was a real anti-disco movement, and it pretty much died very quickly. And it's interesting that right around that time was also when the whole AIDS thing started. So I think it's like a whole backlash from that whole era that's taken 20, 30 years of people then getting scared. And then you add to that the internet, where people can go and you know, date through the internet and text each other and send messages to each other instead of talking to each other. And it adds to what you're saying, I think, a lot of Teflon hearts. And I can only hope that we're moving in the direction of back into each other's arms and back into each other's lives a little bit, you know?
Well, you know, I can remember in the 70s when I first came to New Orleans to go to college, it was just the end of segregation. There was still, you know, however, in the Deep South, segregation never really ended when it was supposed to. There was still a lot of it lingering around. It was just the way things were. You know, I mean, I went to a white Catholic college, and we had black women maids in our dorms, you know. Things like that were just still going on. So I really look at it as though, you know, history had stopped a lot of that, and then we don't want to have any political theories here or any craziness, but if you look at it, you know, when they said, you know, okay, we're going to start to mingle as human beings, and just like you said, along came the hippies, and then with the hippie stuff, you know, people really started to mesh in disco and everything, and then everybody did start to mesh. So it was really, you know, I see it as, you know, the end of segregation was the beginning of it, and then take it a little bit further, and that really did make a big difference.
Yeah.
And you know, now we you say, you know, everybody needs to start opening up and coming back together, and I really think that we will, because this global warming crisis now, or the survival,
right.
And the Earth is really in a funk. It is in a bad spot, and
yeah.
You have to look at it and say, well, how did it get there? Well, let's start pointing the fingers. You know, everybody's going to be pointing their fingers, and then one day it's just, you know, I don't know, something crazy is going to happen, but all of these things, you have to start helping people, just like Katrina, you had to help people. But then people
yeah.
like to take it, you know, politically and say, well, shoulda, woulda, coulda, did this, did that, got slammed, we'll never do that again, learn that lesson.
Right.
But, you know,
right.
they need to learn the lessons the opposite way. So I think we will have a lot more crises and political and disasters or whatever we need to have a restructure in our hearts that we'll be able to start doing that. I really do believe that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we had the same similar lessons after 9/11.
Right.
know, for a few weeks after that, people were walking around and they were actually smiling at each other, you know.
Right.
Slowing down. And I remember it was 3 or 4 days after before I heard the first car beep its horn and everybody on the street just turned around and looked at that car like
yeah.
you just interrupted the quiet. I mean, if you can imagine
mm-hmm.
being in Midtown, New York, and not hearing a horn blare for 4 days, it's pretty incredible. But, you know, there was one of my favorite incidences also was some of us used to go down to the West Side Highway, and it was a group of us with balloons and pom-poms and all that, all different kinds
mm-hmm.
of people. And we would cheer the first responders as they came back up at the end of the day.
Right.
And we cheered. And it was just, it brought tears to my eyes. You know, like we didn't have money. Nobody knew what to do, but we knew that showing appreciation and putting a hand out and giving a hug was part of the solution somehow, you know?
Yeah, and that's just a part of, like, as we've said, this whole show is of melting of hearts, which is really the most important thing that you've said in your book is, you know, how can you melt it? Because you protected it, you melted it, this is how you did it, and that's, you know, the best story ever.
Thank you. Yeah, people are responding to this in very positive ways, and I'm really proud of that, because during the writing process, of course, as a writer, you never know how people are going to be impacted by it. You start
right.
to doubt your own talent sometimes when you're going
yeah.
through all the rewrites. So, I'm very grateful that people are already. It's only been out like a month, and people are emailing me and saying how much the book has made an impact and made them think about. A lot of these issues. So, just a very big blessing that came from some very difficult times. So, yeah.
Yeah, and we know that more are coming, so I guess we had better hurry up and start figuring out what we're going to do about it, you know.
Right.
Shoring up ourselves and taking care of ourselves and, you know, paying attention is really the most important thing.
Yeah, we are not... you know, we're not immune. Nobody, the rich, the you know, whatever race, religion, class, we're not immune
right.
to the hard times. They are coming, and I think we have to be willing to open our hearts and our minds and fix ourselves and know ourselves and know and you know, I think it's very easy now to, as I say to my college students, to walk out the door and put the earphones in our ears and listen to music
yeah.
and ignore the world around us. And I think this is one of the downsides of technology, you know. But that doesn't mean you're immune, you know. Death and destruction and bad relationships and all those things are going to happen, and all of that tuning the world out is not going to help you solve those problems when that time comes, you know?
Absolutely. You know, you just have to do the best you can, but the point is we just don't want to be on the wrong end of the stick. We need to be going, you know, a little bit better. We don't want to always be stirring the soup, you know, and having it really getting... not good. We want to be doing better things, you know. So that's really the best part about it. You know, we always like to say that people don't exist in a bubble. That's another cliche phrase. Another one is, you know, we always say this is for the different classes. You know, everybody is, no one is immune, and that's true because, hey, when you get sick and you go to the hospital, does only the rich people, are they changing your bed, or only the rich people, the ones that are your doctors, are only rich people, the ones that paint the building and wash the windows? You know, everybody is in this together. This is a web. You know, we cannot continue to hold labels again like we've always done, and I think that's really what is so vitally important each time something comes up to say, I'm not going to put a label on it, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I think that's very well said, because you don't know who that person is, and that's another lesson I had to kind of overcome too, is you don't know who that person is who's going to suddenly come around the corner, and it could be somebody that completely turns your life upside down and changes your life and for the better or something, as was in my case, and who knew that this would be kind of a drifter kind of person who had, you know, like issues in his past and things like that, and I'm just going about my business trying to finish my graduate degree and do my teaching and things like that. But we can't go through life and say, well, this is what I'm looking for in a mate, and this is what I'm looking for and I want, you know, two children exactly, and this is what I want for a wife or a husband or a partner, you know, and we make these preconditions, and then your heart is closed in a way, because you're not open to suddenly, maybe you have a graduate degree, but that person who's washing your windows might be the person for you, you know?
Right.
So you don't know.
You know, a lot of times people like to make a puzzle. You know, I always call them, they take a picture of what they want, and then, you know, these vision board things, I'm going to put those pictures up there. Well, then they end up with a puzzle, and then what happens is that when something in that puzzle isn't quite the right shade or isn't quite the right location or quite the right thing, and may have just like a nick out in the corner, everybody says, well, that's not, I don't recognize it. That's not what I want. And, you know, maybe what you're supposed to have is maybe just to be open to a possibility, and so many people cannot be open to those possibilities anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Well, goodness, Kevin, we have burned through the whole hour pretty fast. And see, Cool Joe is great.
I had a feeling it would, because, you've really latched onto the ideas here that came up in the book. And there's a lot to talk about. And I think with the book, it will raise a lot of questions. And I hope keep you turning the pages as well. So.
Absolutely. So could you give our listeners some information about how to find out more about you and to purchase the book? That would be wonderful.
That would be great. So, yes, my name is Kevin Scott Hall, three names there, and you can go to kevinscotthall.com for my website for any updates. There's also links there to the books and my music. My book is available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. If they don't have it on the shelves, you can ask for it, and they can get it for you, or on their website. Or you can go to the publisher, wisdommoonpublishing.com, and it gives you links to all the other ways you can get the book or the ebook. And again, the name of the book is A Quarter Inch from My Heart.
Great. And can you also we have about 3 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about your music.
Okay. So you know, I was one of those dreamers. I came to New York back in the 80s. Wanted to be an actor, and then that kind of transitioned into singer-songwriter, and I did that for many years and put out a couple of recordings, and one of them is still available. It's called New Light Dawning. It came out in 1998, and that one got some airplay around the country. I was very proud of that, and some great songs on there, and original and a couple of covers as well. And that you can find on cdbaby.com, and then just put my name in the search bar, and that will come up. And you can get the whole album, or you can get download individual songs for 99 cents. But, yeah, hoping to get back to the music one of these days. I've become, you know, a bit of a music journalist, so I've interviewed a lot of people, and you can see those interviews on my website as well, some of the famous and not so famous people that I've interviewed, which has been kind of another great learning experience.
Yes, so you can mesh them all together because they don't have a label, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, you will see all types, all kinds.
That's right. Well, you know what, too? I think that music is probably going to be your other little quarter of the inch of the heart that you need to go, so maybe you need to get back to it.
Maybe so.
Yeah. It just might be a good idea, right?
Yeah. You know, and the funny thing with the music, I think music is the universal language of the heart. And
Right. For
a while I had to shut that down because I was so, for a while I got so angry and bitter about the business, you know. And now that I've come through some of these experiences, I think it's time to think about the possibilities and find my heart in that again rather than focus on the business side of it, which can is another one of those things that can shut down the heart.
Well, I think one of the best things in the world now is that you can self-publish. You don't need to worry about anybody reading your stuff. You just put it out there. Same thing with music. Put it on YouTube, make your own CDs, and you're done with it. Because you don't have to wait for anyone else's judgment anymore.
Right.
And I think that's one of the best things ever.
Yeah, it's like a democracy. We can all do it. You know, we don't have to wait for the big guns or the big labels to come along.
Yeah, well, you couldn't even do it before. You couldn't even have a way of even producing it. Or, you couldn't even sit down with a microphone and do it. So now we're all ready. So you have no more excuses. So we'll be waiting on our next show for Kevin Scott Hall to do his music.
All right, great.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I really had a good time, and love talking about these ideas, and thank you for your time. It was really wonderful.
Thank you so much. And if you'd like more information about Kevin Scott Hall, his book is A Quarter Inch from My Heart. It's a memoir. The link is on today's show page, and also the link is there directly to his website. So thank you so much for being with us today, Kevin.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
All right. Take care.
So if you'd like any more information about Kevin, his links are on today's show page. Please do visit there. And if you'd like any more information, it is on his website also. And please do check out his music. It's great. And it is on cdbaby.com. You just put in Kevin Scott Hall and his music will come up. And thank you so much for being with us today. It's a pleasure. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. And until tomorrow, have a wonderful day.